Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining me this evening, listening to one of the most chilling encounters. The real life story behind the hit movie, The Conjuring. Andrea Perrin, the oldest child of the Perrin family that was featured in the hit chiller movie last year, The Conjuring, is here talking to us about her life in the House of Darkness, House of Light. We've heard some disturbing accounts already, Andrea, some frightening firsthand accounts that include physical attacks, marring, scrapes, bruising. The question at hand, why would this family, especially with young children, stay in this house one day longer?
It's a very good question, and it deserves a full, complete answer, so I'll give it to you. And this is how I tell people who ask me this all over the country, really from all over the world, why did you stay? It's a very complicated answer, and it's a very simple answer. I'll start with the simple answer. There was a cosmic confluence of events, a convergence which took place that caused us to go to that farm. We went where we were supposed to, and we stayed as long as we did because we were supposed to. And I don't know why to this day. I do not know why. I can't tell you. But I will tell you that it took my parents 6 months to get the financing together for a 200-acre farm that my father didn't even want until he actually went and saw it. I'll tell you, Dave, when you've got five little kids that are screaming, no, no, Mommy, we don't want to sell the house, it's not that bad, because we didn't know what was happening to her yet. We loved it there. It was paradise. It was the most beautiful piece of property I have ever seen in my life, and I've been everywhere. It is an extraordinary place, and we were so drawn to it that what we figured as kids was that we'd just get used to it. It was our new reality. And so, therefore, and keep in mind, my father in the 70s, you know, the man was the head of household, and that was that. And he didn't believe what he was being told. For a very long time, it created much consternation between my parents because we were all raised to be honest. My mother was raised to be honest. She'd rather swallow her tongue than tell a lie to anyone, especially her husband. And he doubted our rendition of events, our version of events, and what that meant. Because going back to your earlier question, he felt a decided lack of control. He was the head of the household. He had a wife and five little girls to take care of. He was an on-the-road salesman. He was gone a lot. There were no locks. There were no keys to the house. The house was completely open and exposed and vulnerable, and it had about a bajillion doors. And it was extremely unnerving to my father. He didn't want to believe what he was being told. And when you're a little child and the person that you look up to the most doesn't even want to hear it, let alone believe what's coming out of your mouth, you stop talking about it, stop sharing. So the only one, and we didn't even tell our mother what was happening to us until a good 6 months into the time that we were there, and I'm the one that approached her, because by that time, April had something going on with a little spirit in the chimney closet, and we knew she was disappearing for lengths of time, and we were hearing her talk to him, but we couldn't see him. Cindy's the only other one that saw him. I never did, but he was in there, and his name was Oliver, and he was April's little friend, so she had that thing going on that she wouldn't share with anyone. That was her private little relationship with her own little ghost. Nancy was having issues. Cindy was having huge issues. Christine was terrified out of her mind and wouldn't go anywhere in the house, including the bathroom, without being accompanied, because we were all highly scrutinized in that house. There was, you know, there's a lot of talk about the female presence that was after my mother and after my mother, and there is absolutely no proof anywhere that it was Bathsheba Sherman. In fact, it's very highly likely that it was not her, because she died of paralysis, and the spirit that was coming after my mother obviously had a broken neck. There was no question about it. Her desiccated hornet's nest-looking head was hanging off the side of her shoulders. So it wasn't, most likely it was not Bathsheba, but there was a male presence in that house that was malignant, and that was, and we don't know what it was, because the ones that we were able to visualize, whether it be Manny, the one we called Manny, or the one, we named them like pets, you know, because there were so many of them that the only way to, when we would talk amongst each other about encounters, we had to have a name to refer to so that the other sisters would know who they were talking about. And then the little girl started showing up that would cry for her mother, and then the other little girl. And then we realized that it was the same little girl, but dressed in different outfits at different times of her demise, we think. We're not sure. I mean, we're not sure. There are so many children's, there are so many little tombstones in the Arnold Cemetery. It's heartbreaking to climb that fence and to go in there. Some of them don't even have names inscribed on them. So many kids died. So many people died in that house. When we moved in there, eight generations of one extended family had owned from the time, from the inception of the deeding of that property to when we took possession of it, it had been in one extended family for eight generations. And so a lot of people lived and died in that house, and at least a dozen of them never left.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll find out more about these individual entities that the Perrin family was encountering. What unique things did they bring with them? And what does this all mean? Why is this house such a mecca of paranormal activity? We'll find out the answers to those questions and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. Andrea Perrin, our guest, she is an experiencer, a survivor of the real story that inspired the hit chiller movie, which is running like crazy right now on HBO, The Conjuring. So make sure you go DVR that while you're listening to the interview, and then you can watch it in the safety of light tomorrow and be thankful this isn't your family. It seems funny to me as we're discussing this story, Andrea. The movie is terrifying. It is one of the best suspense thrillers and true horror movies I've seen in probably a good 10 to 15 years. And they've got some great stuff in there. We're going to get to some of the discrepancies, but it seemed like the reality was so terrifying, they didn't need to make things up. Was it a little confusing to you as to why they took artistic license and didn't just stick with true encounters that took place all the time?
It's not confusing to me at all. The real story was so intense and so compelling and so disturbing that they sent that script back seven times in order to tone it down and tone it down and tone it down. Because, in fact, there is, you've read the books, there's not a single scene in the film The Conjuring that comes directly from the books. And they did that for a couple of reasons. They were trying to get a PG-13 rating, which they didn't. I was with James Wan when the MPAA sent down the R rating, and he had to be peeled off the ceiling and wanted to know immediately why. Because there's no gratuitous sex or violence or even bad language in there. It is about as clean a horror movie as you'll ever see ever. And the MPAA immediately came back with, it's just too scary. And he wanted to know what scenes needed to be taken out for him to get the PG-13 rating. And they said, there's nothing you can take out of this movie that's going to change our minds. This is not kid stuff. And you know what? I agree with them. They're right. But
I would
they
too.
Thought if they told the real story, if they told what they knew based on what Mrs. Warren gave them and what I gave them for the screenwriters to work with, they felt that it would literally run people right out of the theaters. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote these books the way I did. I take people on the journey with us through from volume one through the end of volume three. And I do that deliberately so that it is not written to be horrifying, that it is written to be compelling, but it is also written to be inspiring, because at its essence, it is a love story. And what The Conjuring got absolutely right in the broad strokes is that love conquers fear and good conquers evil all the time. Now, the Warrens, bless their hearts, the Warrens came in 1973. We had already lived there close to 4 years when they came in. Keith Johnson is actually the one who brought them into the case. We don't know how Keith knew to come to our house with his group from Rhode Island College, but he did, and he had a very compelling experience the day that he was there and immediately went to seek out the Warrens, who he was friendly with. And he was a kid himself. He was only 19, and I was 15. So, you know, we got each other. We understood, and I knew that he was there to help. But when the Warrens came in, they kind of kicked him to the curb, and, you know, that whole group, as those are the kids, they're the inexperienced once they don't know. Well, this was bigger than the Warrens could handle. This was,
well, and I do want to mention too, Andrea, Keith Johnson will be the guest on Coast to Coast, I think the second guest this Monday, and his book's Paranormal Realities, he'll be talking about many of the different encounters he's had, and I'm sure probably touch on the Real Conjuring case from his perspective as one of the first investigators on site as well. But right, and to get, and they were young at that time, correct? I mean, this was getting a case involved and getting them into this story. Now you mentioned Lorraine Warren, Ed and Lorraine Warren, two of the most respected and well-known, well-publicized ghost investigators, demonic investigators, paranormal investigators. Many movies, many books have come out based on their cases. They have been involved in the Amityville Horror case, the case from Haunting in Connecticut. They were involved in your case with The Conjuring. I mean, there are so many different stories that this couple has been involved in and intertwined in throughout the years. It's fascinating that, I mean, they seem to be able to touch all of these major hot points in the paranormal universe. I want to go back for just a few seconds, though, Andrea, and talk a little bit about the different entities that were in the house. Like you told me, you said that everybody kind of had their own thing going on with what was going on in that house. Was the little entity that was talking to your one sister, was it only visible to her, or would it once in a while show up for one of the rest of you?
He manifested only once in front of Cindy. Most of his encounters were with April, and most of Cindy's encounters were with the little girl that would cry and come play with her toys in her room. And Cindy got to the point where she felt so bad for that little girl that she would, if she came into her room and her toys had been rearranged from how she left them, then she knew that she was in there playing. And so she would step out of the room and go do something else and give her chance to play. You know, when you're that young and you're just, your whole life is revealing itself, the whole world as we know it three-dimensionally, we're all wide-eyed, wonderful children who are absorbing everything like a sponge. We knew not to talk about this a lot. We knew there was something special and different about our house, and we didn't tell my mother for 6 months. And I finally I'm the one that told her, Mom, that, you know, the kids are coming to me. I was like the third parent. I was always mature for my age. I was twice the size of any of my other sisters. I was the third parent. And when they didn't feel that they could go to Dad, and Mom seemed so distraught that nobody wanted to bring anything to her, they would come to me. And I am the one that broke the news to her that she wasn't the only one having experiences in the house. But at that point, none of us knew how extreme they had been. It got much worse before it got better.
All right, we've got a few minutes left in this segment together. With the different characters that each one of you were encountering, I don't want to get graphic, but I mean, was there anybody in the family that was dealing with any kind of sexual harassment at all from these spirits?
Well, I will tell you this. You know, I'm very careful not to go there. There are things about that, you know, Cindy had her suspicions about what she saw over me in my bed and why I would be flat on my back. And she has her own suspicions about that, but I didn't include any of that in the book. You know, there are a few things that happened in that house that we've kept to ourselves that didn't make it into the trilogy because they were either too personal or too painful to share. And we feel that we have shared about 98% of what happened, of the major manifestations. Many of them happened so repetitiously that I would put the story in once, but then make it, you know, an addenda. This happened over and over and over again, you know, that type of thing. But there are some things, Cindy, you know, had... we all had incidents in that house where we felt that we were being scrutinized, that we had absolutely no personal privacy. And it got to the point that we would, and we all felt a maleficent male presence in that house. But I'll tell you, none of us used the bathroom alone all the years that we were there. And if my father wasn't home, that bathroom door just stayed open. And whoever was in the kitchen kind of kept watch. There was something truly ugly, and I don't know what it was. But, I mean, to this day, we all have issues about taking a shower or, you know, using the bathroom alone. Not, you know, luckily I live with my sister and my mother, and so it's no problem. Leave the door open, you know. But it's something that is ingrained in you, especially as a female, feeling that kind of, you know, nefarious gaze upon you when you're just trying to take care of your body. You know, it was very disturbing and very disarming. And I think that's why all of us are so very modest. You know, it's in our nature. It was ingrained in us from a very early age. I don't know. I don't know if there was anything. I don't think so. But... I do know that I know that evil exists in this world, David. I know that evil exists in this world, and I have lived my life as a spiritual warrior combating it, and so has everyone else in my family. And my mother had to fight her way back from the other side of hell to come back to her children and her family, because as you asked me in the first hour, do I feel that my mother was possessed? I know for a fact that according to Lorraine's definition of oppression, my mother was oppressed. My mother began to change over the course of several years, began dressing in dark vintage clothing from another era, began using archaic language in her speech with us. Her voice began to change. And so I understand why Ed and Lorraine were so alarmed. But whatever it was that took hold of my mother and attacked her the night of the seance was far beyond any of their abilities to handle. And I consider what the medium did that night, calling forth all of the spirits, throwing the doors wide open, I consider that to be spiritual malpractice, because what came through and what came into my mother's body and manipulated her and caused a massive transition to occur and then flung her from one room to the next in a split second. Whatever that was so evil that it subdued the spirits. For months afterwards, we heard nothing from them. They wouldn't even begin to manifest in the house. They were as terrified as we were.
We'll talk about the seance. We'll talk about your encounters with the Warrens. And I understand that it got heated a few times and that there was a lot going on. We'll get into some of the reality of that story as we continue our journey tonight with one another, fleshing this out. I've literally got about a minute left with you in this segment, Andrea. With all that took place, the main question people have is, how can you have all of that and have it split over three books? Why wasn't it all just in one book?
Because it was so huge a story from the perspective of seven different people. If somebody's looking for a series of scary stories, my books are not the books for them. They need to wait for the abridged version. I will tell you that. If you want to go on a spiritual journey, if you want to understand the history, the philosophy, the science, the quantum physics, the everything about what was going on at that house, if you want to come live with us for 10 years at that farm and experience from our perspective individually and from the perspective of the spirits, then delve into the trilogy. Be brave enough to delve into the trilogy, but I will tell you, it will change the way you think about everything for the rest of your life.
Our guest for the evening is Andrea Perrin, one of the experiencers, real-life survivors of the story The Conjuring, a story even more dark and frightening than the chilling movie that was released last year. Again, it's on HBO. You can set your TiVos and DVRs and make sure you don't miss it. It is one of the best movies I've seen in a long time. It will get in your head and it will mess with you. The book's so much more detailed. Again, she's got so much information she could have put in one 1,500-page book, but we all know nobody's going to sit down and read 1,500 pages. She broke them up over three books. House of Darkness, houseoflight.com. Check it out. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this. Thank you for joining me this evening. We'll open up phone lines in the fourth hour if you'd like to call in and have questions for our guest. If you are suffering through an extreme haunting and would like some insight from a woman who has lived through it and continues to help others that are living through it, then you can call in and be a part of the show with us. House of Darkness, House of Light. It is a three-book trilogy, the third book due out any day now. You can find more information by checking out the website, House of Darkness, houseoflight.com. For more stories like this, UFO abductions, monsters, myths, and legends, you can join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central Time at darknessradio.com. Tim Dennis, Dave Schrader, we join speakers from around the world who share their insights and encounters with the strange and unusual. And keep your dial set right there. You can continue to stream right from our website, because as soon as Darkness Radio is over, George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey into the strange and bizarre. Stay tuned. We've got more with our guest, Andrea Perrin, more insights and more terrifying tales behind the real story featured in the movie The Conjuring, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Dave Schrader. I'm your host for this evening. We're talking with Andrea Perrin. She is the author of a trilogy of books, House of Darkness, House of Light, talking about her extensive experiences in a very scary situation. Her family lived in a haunted, reportedly haunted house. So much activity going on. It's off the charts. Reporters, investigators for years have come to this house to try to crack the enigma and understand what's going on. We're talking with one of the survivors, one of the people involved in the real story, Andrea Perrin. And Andrea, I wanted to talk about the Warrens and their involvement in the story. Like you said, they came in a couple years into the experiences that were going on there. And again, I understand for our listeners, and I'm getting pounded by email and Facebook messages and Twitter comments, that it just seems unlikely that a family in danger that bad would stay. There's one thing we have to remember too, folks, we all forget, when you sink everything you have into a new home and a new life, and this isn't part of your world, it's not always easy to just jump to, okay, we need to leave. There's ghosts here. We want, and for experiencers, myself included, we want to rationalize away what's going on in our home. Nightmares, overactive women's imagination. And I'm speaking from a 1970s perspective about that with the case that we're talking about tonight, not meant in any disparaging way towards women, but looking at it through those eyes, I can see how her father, Roger, would want to settle it down and try to get control again. And especially, Andrea, it's got to be frustrating for your father and mother, because there's nothing to grab by the scruff of the neck and throw out of the house. There's nothing to beat into submission and make it leave. It's this ethereal energy that just seems to be permeating and taking over your home. That must have been chaotic for them trying to figure out how to deal with and keep their family together.
Well, it was mostly difficult for my mother because, of course, my father didn't want to hear it. And it was because he admitted years later, and you've spoken with him personally, so you know he'll admit now, that it was because he was terrified. He felt like he had no control over that household, what was going on in it, and he was away so much of the time. Keep in mind also, and thank you for saying what you did, Dave, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, we bought this house in December of 1970, moved in January of 1971, because my mother, for some reason, didn't want to move her entire family at Christmas. And Mr. Kenyon was not quite ready to leave. But when we got there, you know, we all loved this place. We had already spent time there. We loved it. It was like our dream home that turned into a nightmare, literally and figuratively. So it was very difficult for my mother. She was the one initially who said, "We're out of here. We are out of here." I mean, she called our attorney and she said, "I don't care what you have to do to get us out of this house, do it." Well, there were no laws on the books. There had been two attempts that had failed in Superior Court in Rhode Island with people trying to get out of the sale of a house because they moved in and it was haunted. And there was nothing that gave him any latitude in terms of bringing this into a court. So he spoke with a friend of his that was a judge, and he said, "Sam, don't even bother. It's just not going to happen." They had no legal leg to stand on. And, of course, they didn't want to in any way hurt Mr. Kenyon. But the fact of the matter is that Mr. Kenyon knew there were things going on in the house. He visited regularly. And when my mother would ask him about the odd sounds in the parlor, he'd wink at her and say, "Swallows in the chimney, my dear, swallows in the chimney." Well, it was a hell of a lot more than swallows in the chimney, because when she pried the face off of that fireplace in April of that year, when that house was so pervasively cold that there was no way to warm it up, and we had a woodshed filled with seasoned wood, and every fireplace in that house had been inexplicably sealed shut, she tore it open. And the day she did that, all hell broke loose in that house. And that was in April of 1971. We had been there 4 months when that happened. And that afternoon, she went in to take a shower, and one of our neighbors came over with a cake, and she was in the house, and I went to the bathroom door. I said, "Mom, Phyllis is over, and she brought a cake for us." And Mom yelled out of the shower, "I'll tell her I'll be out in a few minutes." And within 2 to 3 minutes, we hear my mother screaming, and we all went running into the bathroom, and she was standing there in the closet, what we called the warm room, which was where the chimney came up through the center of the house, and was being beaten bloody with a heavy wooden coat hanger that had just lifted off of the rack above her head and was pummeling her around the head and neck. And our neighbor saw it, and every single one of us saw it. And when my father came home 2 or 3 days later, and my mother is completely covered in, you know, scratches and abrasions and bruises, and she's telling him this story, he said, "You must have misunderstood, or you must have knocked it down yourself, or you must." He started coming up with 100 different reasons why it had to have some other rational, pragmatic explanation. And at one point, my mother put him up against a wall, and she said, "You know what, Roger? There is a logical explanation for what's going on in this house. We have ghosts." He just didn't want to hear it. You know, everything they had was invested in this house. Everything. And the economy had just tanked. Completely tanked. You remember, you're old enough to remember the Nixon administration, the gas embargoes, the gas lines. You couldn't get heating oil for your house in New England. The oil cartel was founded over in the Middle East so that they could manipulate prices worldwide. Remember all of that?
Sure.
It was just as bad as what we just went through 5 years ago.
I can sympathize with your father in the sense of, as a father myself of a large family and a lot of them women, to want to feel like I'm trying to comment. It's got to be something else. It can't be this, because there's no way you can lay your hands on what the possibility is. I'm very thankful, and we make sure to go out of our way to protect and pray in our house to keep this type of thing from happening. Let me ask you about that. You said that you were a very spiritual family. You are a very spiritual family. Your mother was very upset with the idea in the movie that you were kind of these godless heathens who didn't have anybody baptized, when in fact that's not the case.
Right.
Were you doing things as a family, praying together, doing anything to try to stave off some of this energy?
Well, we were all very prayerful. In fact, we all said our prayers every night before we went to sleep. We, all the five of us, would get together and say our prayers together. And that was just kind of standard fare for us. But I'll tell you, it didn't really have anything to do so much with our religion, even though we had all attended CCD classes and, you know, we knew the creed and we knew all the major prayers and we knew all of that. But what we would do is we would get together as five little girls and we would just talk to God. It wasn't anything that was regimented. It was conversations that we would have, and we'd get together at night before we went to bed for years, and just say, you know, thank you for this that happened today, or thank you for that. A lot of gratitude, a lot of, you know, if I should die before I wake,
right.
You know, that
well,
type
let me
of
ask
thing.
You then that if you're a religious family and you are rooted in theology and all of this continues to happen to you, doesn't it make you question the reality of God or religion? That if it exists, why is this happening to a good family?
No, Dave, I'll tell you what. You will find, and I know you have already found, you're playing devil's advocate right now, I know that you have already found, that people who suffer severe hauntings are usually targeted because they are so close to God, that they're virtually a threat. And I think that that was the case in our family. My mother was not born and raised Catholic. She converted to Catholicism in order to marry my father. She didn't buy into the doctrine and the dogma, but she felt that she was so spiritual and she wanted to raise her children, had a sense of something greater than herself. But I'll tell you, she had been so disillusioned by the Vietnam War, by, you know, just the tumultuous changes in society. Kent State had a dramatic effect on her. She moved into that house really doubting the existence of God and considered herself really closer to an atheist. She's very rooted in science, my mother is, in much the same way that my father is. You know, this didn't make any sense to her any more than it made sense to him. She was just more accepting of it. It was just really a matter of perspective more than anything, and exposure. But I will tell you, the effect that it had on each one of us was very dramatic. And for me, speaking personally, I consider that the 10 best years of my life, because I learned everything that I needed to know about life and death and the afterlife in order to live a good, loving, happy, productive life. People ask me all the time how I can be so optimistic and so filled with love. And so it's how I am and it's who I am. And I strongly suspect that my proclivity for listening to other people's stories and trying to help other people with what they go through in life is because I've gone to the dark side, because I've been exposed to that. And I see that there is a light. And I'll tell you something. When we were in crisis, when anybody in our family was in crisis in that house, when we were in the bubble, when we were screaming and no one could hear us and we were in trouble, Mrs. Warren had said to us, say this phrase, in the name of Jesus Christ, go back to where you came from, leave us in peace. Well, that didn't work because that was nothing but a memorized line that she drummed into our heads to use. I'll tell you what works. Dear God, get here now. Make this stop now. Please, I beg you, come now. And when you say something like that that comes right from your gut, that you feel so viscerally that it literally vibrates in your sternum, and you are begging for assistance, you know what, David? Every single time, whatever was happening to any one of us stopped by imploring the name of God. And I don't know if he sent emissaries. I don't know. I don't even think of God as he. I think of God as it, as the infinite intelligence of the universe, something that is so supremely good that we cannot even conceptualize how benevolent it is, how full of love it is. But you cannot have love without its opposite. And its opposite is not hate. Its opposite is fear. And what I have spent my entire life doing since leaving that farm is working with people one-on-one my whole life to help them dispel the fear of death that they all secretly harbor, that people secretly harbor, and it keeps people from living fully. I have known since the age of 12 years old that there is something beyond our mortal existence, and I can't even now tell you exactly what it is. I don't know, but I will tell you the only thing that I do know is that there is something something, that we are not just ashes to ashes, dust to dust, that that refers only to this physical vessel, and that we are all essentially spiritual beings. Because if we aren't, then we would not have been able to interact with those spirits the way that we did. And there was contact made, and there was communication made. And that's why we waited 30 years to tell our story, so that some people would believe us.
You know, the problem with you, Andrea, is you're just not passionate enough about this story.
I know.
I enjoy.
In person, honey, right. You know, this is the real deal.
No, I do, and I'm fascinated by the story. Let's talk a little bit about bringing, I mean, you had Carl and Keith Johnson, the twins that are our demonologists, paranormal investigators, come in. They ended up informing and turning the information, as I understand, over to the Warrens, who took over from that point. And what was it like? Was your father open and fine with the Johnson boys doing the investigation and what they were finding? And what was his thoughts about bringing Ed and Lorraine in?
He wanted nothing to do with any of them. The day that they pulled into the yard, that Keith pulled into the yard with his pyro group from Rhode Island College, my father was getting ready to leave on a road trip. And my mother said, "Roger, handle this. I don't know who these people are." And he said, "You know what? Tell them to get the hell off the property. I've got to go." And he got in his car and he left with this van full of people that had just pulled into our yard. You know, it's like, okay, let's absolve thyself of any responsibility for dealing with anything that's coming to our door. I gotta go. You know, so it was, and you know, we had to learn to live with that too. We had to learn live with the fact that our father was doing anything he could to avoid anything having to do with paranormal investigators and why are these people here. And then, of course, when Ed and Lorraine showed up, they didn't come for months afterwards. Keith told them, I think he told them, they came in the summertime of 73, late summer. But the Warrens didn't show up to the house until the evening before Halloween. They came at about 7 o'clock, just after twilight, and they got lost. They couldn't find the house because it was set so far back that they didn't see it. But when they came, the first thing, and I will give credit where credit is due. Yes, were they equipped to handle what they encountered in that house? No, absolutely they were not. But I will give credit where it is due to Lorraine Warren. She walked in our kitchen door, introduced herself. My mother had no idea who these people were, absolutely no idea. She never went seeking out any help, ever. It came to us, and, you know, there are some cosmic connections there as well. Which we can explore later if you'd like. But she walked into our house, right over to our black stove, put her hand on the corner of the stove, covered her forehead with her other hand, and said, "I sense a malignant presence in this house. Her name is Bathsheba." And she knew nothing of the history of that house, nothing of the folklore or any documented historical references of anybody that had any attachment to that house. And the thing that's most interesting about that is that prior to our moving to the farm, about 2 or 3 years prior to moving to the farm, my father came home with an African Basenji puppy one day when we were still living in Cumberland. And my mother looked at this dog and she swept her up into her arms and held her to her bosom and said, "This is a very special dog. She deserves a very special name." And she closed her eyes and she tilted her head back to the sky. And when she opened her eyes, she said Bathsheba. And none of us had ever even heard that name. We had no idea that it was a biblical reference. We had never heard that name before. So five little girls, what do? We abbreviate it to Sheba. And she was our Sheba dog. But her name, her official proper name from my mother, was Bathsheba. And what caused my mother to pluck that name out of the ether 3 years before we actually moved to the farm?
That right there in itself is a strange encounter. I want to talk about, and we've teased about it a little bit here in the last couple of segments, about the seance and what occurred. There was no exorcism as appeared in the movie, for those of you that are fans of the movie The Conjuring, although her mother was under oppression and was most likely dealing with the beginnings of possession. There was no exorcism that was performed in the house, but there was a seance. What took place during the seance? What was the encounters like with Ed and Lorraine Warren And did things get heated? Well, we're going to continue talking with our guest this evening. We've got another 2 hours with her. We'll talk with her for the next hour, then open up phone lines so you, the listeners, get a chance to actually talk with her. We'll discuss this and so much more. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.